We'll have the chaos that we had last week. Our geniuses, led by Danny Sanchez, have figured everything out. And everybody says loud and clear. Okay, so this is week two of the Road to Serfdom. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is a number of things that are surprisingly as relevant today as they were in the 1940s. When Hayek was writing the book, I suppose that's why the book is still so popular. It's why it was number one in sales about 1 year ago on Amazon.com. And the same is true, I guess, of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which is still selling several hundred thousand copies every year because it rings true. And so the first thing to talk about is Hayek is writing about the argument that government planning is inevitable. In his day, for decades, the argument had been made that the way the economy was going, because of technological developments especially, planning was inevitable. And I can recall once doing a research project where I read through all of the old copies of Paul Samuelson's famous textbook, Economics. And this was the biggest selling textbook in the world from 1948, when it first appeared, until around the 1980s. And he made that argument over and over and over again that some kind of planning was inevitable because of all the problems inherent in capitalism. But in particular, what Hayek is talking about is the argument that technological change, technological change in his day was mostly, as of the 1940s, change in the technology of manufacturing. After all, Hayek lived most of his life in the machine age, even though he anticipated the information age by 50 years or more. And on that topic, by the way, there's an article in the New Yorker magazine maybe 10 or 12 years ago called The Price Prophet, and it's spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, and it's all about Hayek and how his famous article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, which I put on the syllabus for last week, published in the 1940s, anticipated the internet and the flow of information on the web. 50, 60 years before it actually happened. So I recommend looking that up if you're interested. But technological change, what he's referring to particularly in this chapter is called natural monopoly. When he says that the argument is made that either we're going to have private monopolies or government planning in the public interest. Those are the only alternatives. And the technological change that he's referring to is the technology of mass production that had been leading to economies of scale and declining long-run cost per unit of production of steel, automobiles, just cement, just about everything in manufacturing from the end of the 19th century to the 1940s when he was writing The Road to Serfdom. And so that's what he's referring to. And so I wrote on the chat about one of my articles entitled The Myth of Natural Monopoly. It was published some years ago in the Review of Austrian Economics. I have it right here in front of me here. You can see that's my copy. And one of the things that I showed there is that this story that economies of scale or declining long-run costs per unit was leading to monopoly was just a myth. It never happened that way. And I'll give you one example from this article, which is online, by the way, I quoted the economist Harold Demsetz, spelled D-E-M-S-E-T-Z. He was a UCLA economist, and he wrote a book of essays called Efficiency, Competition, and Public Policy. And here's one of the things he said about what was going on in the U.S. in the late 19th, early 20th century, which is the period Hayek is writing about. He said this: six electric light companies were organized in 1 year in 1887 in New York City. 45 electric light enterprises had the legal right to operate in Chicago in 1907. Prior to 1895, Duluth, Minnesota was served by five electric lighting companies, and Scranton, Pennsylvania had four. Then he goes on to say that competition was common and especially persistent in the telephone industry. Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, Columbus, Detroit, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis all had at least two telephone services. And so what was going on is there was not this tendency toward monopoly, natural monopoly, as it is called in the economics books. There was vigorous competition that was happening. And so right away in this chapter, The Inevitability of Planning, Hayek takes this on, and that's what he's referring to. It's a myth that large-scale production necessarily leads to monopoly. And by the way, another old article of mine that was published, I don't think it's easily available online, but part of it is alluded to in this Myth of Natural Monopoly article. So if you get that one, you can read how I surveyed some of the economists who were writing on this subject in the late 19th century when all this technological change was happening, with technology of large-scale mass production that was leading to lower and lower costs. None of them saw this as a threat to monopoly, and almost every single economist of the day was opposed to antitrust regulation as a matter of principle. They thought it was inherently incompatible with competition, and so they opposed it for that reason. But when monopoly did occur in the so-called public utility industries, it was created by government intervention, and Hayek says this also. He refers mostly to Europe. He alludes to Germany, which created monopolies and cartels, as did the U.S. But here's how it happened. There was a book that I dug up in part of my research on this article on the myth of natural monopoly on the Gaslight Company of Baltimore, which today is called Baltimore Gas and Electric. And here's how it happened. In 1890, a bill was introduced in the Maryland legislature which called for an annual payment to the city government from the Consolidated Gas Company of $10,000 a year and 3% of all dividends declared in return for the privilege of enjoying a 25-year monopoly. This is exactly what happened in most other cities in America, in that there wasn't a free market monopoly. There was vigorous competition, and so these companies went to the government when they failed to form a cartel privately, which always does fail. They run to the government, and they made a deal. They said, we will split the loot with you. You create a monopoly, a legal monopoly for us, and we will split the loot. We'll give you $10,000 and 3% of our dividends. And so it was a way of taxation, was what it was, indirect taxation. And so the interventionists of Hayek's time posed a false choice. The choice was not between private monopoly or government planning of these industries. It was between competition, which existed, and some sort of government monopoly. That's what the choice was. And the choice that was chosen in most cities was government-run monopoly, government-created monopoly. Either a government-run monopoly, government-owned utilities, natural gas, water supply, electricity, and so forth, telephone, or the grant of a monopoly privilege to a private company like this, where they would split the loot. Either way, the government would benefit by organizing and profiting from a monopoly. Hayek next alludes to the Marxian myth of increased concentration. But before I get on to that, I want to mention sort of an amusing aside here, in that I quote in my paper an economist named Horace Gray, who said this back in the early 20th century. He's writing about in the late 19th century. It was widely believed that the public interest would best be promoted by grants of special privilege to private persons and corporations. Who would ever believe that? This included patents, subsidies, tariffs, and land grants to railroads and monopoly franchises for so-called public utilities. The final result was monopoly, exploitation, and political corruption. And he goes on to say that just about everybody said, well, I'm a public utility too. Where's my monopoly? You know, once they started handing out monopolies by the governments. And so the next thing Hayek talks about is the Marxian myth of increased industrial concentration. And what Karl Marx said was that capitalism would lead to increased consolidation through mergers, corporate mergers, that would end up in just one big company controlling everything. And like most things, Karl Marx had it all exactly backwards. It was under socialism, where the government owned all the means of production, that you had one big monopoly, not under capitalism. Capitalism is the opposite. So it was under the system that Marx advocated that you actually did have one big monopoly. But the economics profession took this seriously for a long, long time. There's a whole field subdiscipline of industrial organization, and it's been around for quite a while. And it began in the 1930s and 40s. And up until that time, most economists who wrote on the subject of competition thought of it like the Austrian economists do. They thought of it as dynamic, for one thing, that is never ending. It's a process, and it's a discovery process. Through the market process, consumers discover what's out there, that they want. Businesses discover the best way to produce things. They discover what consumers want through trial and error. They discover what kind of advertising works. They discover whether mergers are economical or not, and that tells them what the optimal size of their business ought to be in order to maximize their profits. So the market is a dynamic discovery process, and it involves entrepreneurship, it involves arbitrage, it involves price cutting, advertising, product innovation, all these things. That view of competition was eclipsed at the beginning around the 1930s by the economics profession, which defined it in terms of the perfect competition model that some of you have studied in school, at the university level anyway. And what it eventually led to was using as a totally different measuring stick of competition, that is industrial concentration, how many firms there are in an industry, or more precisely, there are ratios such as a four-firm concentration ratio, which would be the percentage of sales in one industry by the four largest firms in the industry by sales. It's an arbitrary thing, but that's what economists have used for many years, and different variants of that. It's not the only type of concentration ratio. And so the idea was the more concentrated an industry, there's fewer firms that dominate sales, the more monopolistic it is. And it was just assumed that that meant monopoly. Now, this has all been eclipsed in its own right by a lot of research done by the Austrian economists and also Chicago School economists. And in a nutshell, what they proved was that, as a rule, any firm or firms that have a high market share that lasts a good bit of time, you know, a number of years, did so by simply being producing better quality products and or cheaper products than the competition. There might be exceptions to that in terms of companies that lobby for special privileges from the government, but in the free market, the only way to get a big market share and to dominate is to be better than the competition. And I alluded to in the chat one article that is sort of a very early seminal article discussing this that shows the kind of research that went into this by mostly the Chicago School economists, but when they researched, they became very Austrian in their perspective in that they looked at markets as dynamic and ongoing. And it's the article by Yale Brosen that I mentioned in the chat. It's called Are U.S. Manufacturing Markets Monopolized? And it was reprinted in the Freeman when Brosen passed away. And I believe it had an introduction by David Henderson at the time. I remember reading that at the time. And so, and there's a classic book on this, if anyone is interested in this whole area of research. It's edited by Yale Brosen. It's called Concentration, Mergers, and Public Policy. Another good book on the subject is Antitrust and Monopoly by Dominic Armentano. And so this whole idea that concentration would lead to one big monopoly, of course, never happened except under socialism. And the variant of that idea that industrial concentration per se was monopolistic, even if it did not lead to just one big monopoly, that has been shattered also by the economics profession, by the Austrians and the Chicago School economists. Another point that Hayek makes here, that he made in one of the first couple of chapters that we discussed last class, is during his time the argument was made that in a more complex, more technologically sophisticated society, we have to plan. The government has to plan. Not we, but the government has to plan, or else there will be all kinds of problems, which I'll mention shortly. In this chapter, Hayek reiterates his main point that if you understand the use of knowledge in society of the sort that allows an economy to operate, the knowledge that is used has to be highly decentralized. It's the knowledge of time and place, as he once called it, where millions of free people specialize in whatever particular job they perform, whatever type of business they manage, and so forth. And it is the information that is in the minds of all those people, those millions of people, that allows the division of labor to bring us up out of barbarism into civilization itself. And so Hayek makes the point that the more technological advanced, the more complex the society is, the bigger the imperative to rely on free markets and to avoid government planning, because government planning has the pretense of knowledge. It pretends it can make use of all of this vast knowledge in the minds of millions of people, which is absurd and ridiculous, and it never had. And, of course, government planning is always ham-fisted, bureaucratic, and everything else, corrupt. I could sit here all night and think of words to use for that. Hayek also touches on, at one point, on what a phrase that became famous through Joseph Schumpeter, the old Harvard economist who died in 1950. He wrote this famous book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And what he is most known for, if there's any economics book, principles of economics book that mentions Schumpeter, that's, I believe it's S-C-H-U-M-P-E-T-E-R, is how it's spelled, Joseph Schumpeter, they mention the phrase creative destruction. He thought capitalism would essentially destroy itself because innovations were so quickly imitated that there wasn't going to be enough profit in them. And that an invention comes about, a new product, the consumers like it, it catches on, the company makes profit for a very short time, and then competition floods in and it kills the profit. So Schumpeter's prediction was just the opposite of Marx, with too much competition. And he was just as wrong as Marx, because products that people like do have staying power for quite a long time, although no company, especially in today's economy, can sit on its laurels, as the saying goes, and not be innovating and creating newer and better products if they want to stay in business a long time. And so, but this argument that there's so much competition out there, see, the socialists argue from both sides of their mouths. They were saying, well, there's too much monopoly. Everything's tending toward monopoly. And at the same time, they're saying, but there's too much competition, too. And because of that, it's not profitable enough to innovate. Therefore, government must be in charge of innovation. We must have patents, for example, to create monopolies for different goods, because these goods and products can't stand on their own without government protection. Hayek makes the case that that's nonsense. Good quality products that serve the consumer will be profitable, and they always have been. And there's an excellent quote on page 62. I call it the planner's mindset, the mindset of a government planner. I thought I'd read, worth reading, where Hayek says, government planning would make the very men who are most anxious to plan society the most dangerous if they were allowed to do so, and the most intolerant of the planning of others. From the saintly and single-minded idealist to the fanatic is often but a step. And that reiterates Hayek's point that, of course, we all plan. It's a false choice to say that we need to plan or have chaos. We all plan. We all plan our lives, our jobs, our families, our businesses, everything. The question is, who is to do the planning? And so in the marketplace, business people who plan production and marketing and pricing and everything else that goes into business always have the consumer looking over their shoulder. They have to please the customer if they want to stay in business. When you have government planning, the plans of these individuals, of the consumers and the business owners, are replaced by the whims of government bureaucrats who no longer have to pay attention to the wishes of consumers, because they're funded by tax dollars, not by the consumers. And so, and Hayek, of course, understood that when he wrote The Road to Serfdom. He was a world-class economist long, long before he ever wrote The Road to Serfdom. Well, I just read that from Well, I happen to have here the question here in the chat, 1976 edition. It's the very last page of chapter 4, by the way. And by the way, I have several editions. This is also the 76 edition, but I have Hayek's signature on it. So I thought I'll hold up the camera. Maybe, I don't know, I guess you can see Hayek's signature there. I met Hayek in 1983 at George Mason University when I was on the faculty there. I was a young whippersnapper back then. I also got this book signed by Hayek. I tried to dig out an old picture I have of him and me, but I couldn't find it. It's down in the basement somewhere. Maybe the next class I'll find it for you. But that was the 76th edition. The last page of chapter 4 is what I was reading from. You know, on the issue of democracy, planning a democracy, Hayek says that all forms of collectivism are inevitably totalitarian, and of course they are, because the collectivist approach wants to impose one view on everybody, one policy on everybody, and so you know, how else would you define totalitarianism? That the totality of society has to go just one way, the way that the planner wants to impose on you, and that ultimately is what collectivism is all about. He also talks about the myth of the common good, government planning and statism in general, interventionism is always sold in the name of the common good. But of course, Hayek is right when he says there is no such thing as the common good. Individuals are all unique. We all have brains. Our brains are all different. Our preferences are different. Our outlook on things is different. We have some things in common. But there can be no such thing as the common good. And what that presumes, Hayek says, is that it is possible for some person or persons to have in their mind all of the preferences, all the preference scales, if you wish, of the millions of people that comprise a society or a country. And that, of course, is ridiculous. But that's what the presumption is when people use phrases like the common good. Hayek says this, he says, the individual is the ultimate judge of his ends. No outsider, no economist, no government planner can judge for you, what your most desired ends are. That's your business, that's your opinion in a free society. Okay, and so in the field of economics, this presumption is still alive. There's some apparatus called the social welfare function. It still is used by some economists, mathematical economists mostly, but it's all phooey. It's not possible for the preferences of millions of individuals to be added up. To do that, utility, which is the word economists use for well-being or welfare, you know, how well off you are, would have to be measurable and cardinal. You would have to somehow, attach a device to a person's head and measure how many utils he or she gets from making one choice versus another choice. And of course, that's ridiculous because the utility is subjective. It's not objective. It's not measurable. It's in the eye of the beholder. The individual is the ultimate judge of his ends, as Hayek says. And so he takes this on, the whole idea of the common good. And this is related to the next point he makes. He makes another point that my old professor, James Buchanan, one of his very first articles out of graduate school in the 1940s, was on the subject of what he called political externalities. And Hayek is referring to this phenomenon in this one passage in chapter 5. And what he's talking about is in a democracy, when we have majority rule voting, Usually, if it works the way it's supposed to work, the best you can get is that the median voter will pretty much get what they want from government. That is, the people whose ideology is sort of middle of the road, because that is where most voters are, and that is where the politicians will pander to the majority of voters if they want to be elected, if they want to stay in office. But then you have a situation of where people on the far right, let's say, to use the old-fashioned left-right political language, people on the far right who want much smaller government can't get it because in a majority rule democracy, we have all or none decision making. If you vote for a legislator or a president or even a policy, the majority picks one policy or one individual. You don't get to have your individual. Like in the market, if I like Pepsi-Cola and you like Coca-Cola, we can each get what we want. But if we use democracy to choose and Coca-Cola gets a majority, then we all have to drink Coca-Cola regardless of our preferences. And so, and then people on the far left who want government to be much bigger than it is, they can't get what they want either because they have to go along with what the majority voted on. And so these, the people on the left and right who are unhappy because of the political outcome, that's called political externalities in the language of James Buchanan. And the Nobel Prize, when he won the Nobel Prize in economics in 1986, I believe it was, Hayek won the Nobel Prize in 1974. Hayek doesn't use the word political externalities, but this is what he's referring to in Chapter 5 to make the point that there are many diverse interests in a democracy. And so if you have planning, what does planning do? Planning imposes one plan on the whole society. Therefore, you're going to create many, many political externalities and a great deal of unhappiness in doing it. And so that's one point he makes to make the point that planning and democracy are inherently incompatible. There's a quote on the essence of state control also in this chapter. My version, it's page 68. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's about 6 pages into the chapter where he makes this point. Once the communal sector, and he's talking about the government sector, in which the state controls all the means, exceeds a certain proportion of the whole, the effects of its actions dominate the whole system. Although the state controls directly the use of only a large part of the available resources, the effects of its decisions on the remaining part of the economic system become so great that indirectly it controls almost everything. And then he goes on to say that where, as was, for example, true in Germany as early as 1928, the central and local authorities directly controlled the use of more than half of the national income, they controlled indirectly almost the whole economic life of the nation. And he's saying through regulation, presumably. Now, if you compare that, he's saying Nazi Germany. It wasn't quite Nazi Germany yet in 1928. That's before Nazi Germany, 1928. The government was controlling 53% of the economy outright, and then the rest it pretty much controlled because that's what fascism was. It was they allowed some private property, but it was very heavily controlled and regimented by the government to serve the purposes of the government, not the purposes of the consumers. And if you compare that to the U.S. today, if you were to look up tax revenues from all sources paid to the federal, state, and local governments in the U.S., and divide that by national income, you can get statistics on national income, you'll find that it's over 40%. That's one way of looking at the size of government, just in terms of its tax take. And, of course, in addition to that, there are hundreds of regulatory agencies at all levels of government that regulate pretty much all aspects of American life. Even the president's wife, Michelle Obama, a few months ago, even wanted the government to subsidize breast pumps for pregnant women. There's nothing that is off limits for the federal government at all in the U.S., it seems, anymore. And so the government taxes away at least 40% of all national income to use for its own purposes. And then it regulates in an extreme way much of the rest of the economy. And one article that I alluded to in the chat is the one by George Reisman. I forget the exact title, but if you go on Mises.org and look up George Reisman, it's on the myth that laissez-faire was responsible for the current economic crisis. And he just mentions how heavily the housing industry in particular is regulated by several cabinet departments and a lot of other regulatory agencies also. And that's the point Hayek made way back in the 1940s, and it seems similar to what the U.S. government is doing today. Another point he makes that's worth commenting on here is that in his day, planning, government planning was always made, the argument was always made for it in the name of promoting prosperity. And of course, that always failed. But then after it failed, governments never give up. Once they gain or grasp the power to plan some segment of society, they never give up, and they end up trying to plan all other aspects of people's lives. And so economic planning is just the beginning of it. Once government grabs the power to do that, it will plan everything. It will do everything it can to plan everything. And I think we can see that in today's world, certainly in the United States, where the government tries to plan everything, pretty much. There's another good quote here in The Road to Serfdom, where Hayek says, "A socialist government must not allow itself to be too much fettered by democratic procedure." And what he means by this is that, you know, there are inherently many, many conflicts in society over economics. People have different interests. And so when the government gets in the business of imposing a plan on the society, it inevitably is going to help some people but with the plan and harm other people. That's the way democracy works. And so if the people who are harmed oppose it and start working in politics to overthrow the plan, you can't have planning. You cannot have planning if the democratic process can be used to foil the plan. And so that's what Hayek means when he says a socialist government must not allow itself to be too much fettered by democratic procedure. Democracy can ruin planning. So social democracy, democratic socialism, all these variants of planning, they're all a myth. You know, because of the fact that the planner has an imperative to impose a single plan on everyone. That's the whole idea of government planning. Another sort of a entertaining point that he makes is kind of entertaining to me in that he says that the delegation of powers by planners, the planners inevitably in a larger country will have to delegate some powers. And so then what happens is when the plan fails, as it inevitably does, because of the knowledge problem, Hayek would say, the pretense of knowledge, then the planners will start making the argument that, well, we need more unity of aim. We need a one plan. We have too many plans because we delegated too much power. And it's kind of funny to me because I've written some articles. If you go and find an old article of mine called Economic Fascism, it was published in the Freeman some years ago. I think I put it on the syllabus somewhere in for this course. I quote Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, in the 1980s as making this exact argument. He said, well, we have a lot of planning in the United States, but it's too disjointed. We need unity of aim. We need one plan. And so he was calling for some sort of economic dictatorship. And of course, today we would not, in the U.S., we would not call these people economic dictators. We call them czars, C-Z-A-R, czars. And I just got off the web a list of all of Obama's czars. And of course, Bush had czars too. I think he had 16 of them. The first time I recall hearing about a czar in America was the energy czar of the 1970s, William Simon. It was a Republican politician. But here's some of Obama's czars or dictators, the dictators in charge of different areas of public policy. An Afghanistan czar, auto recovery czar, AIDS czar, border czar, California water czar, car czar, central region czar, domestic violence czar, drug czar, faith-based czar with a czar over the churches, a Great Lakes czar, green jobs czar, health czar, information czar, international climate czar, pay czar, he's going to regulate the pay of all the corporations, science czar, a Sudan czar in charge of the country of Sudan, terrorism czar, technology czar, on and on and on. And so this is exactly what Hayek is warning about in the 1940s that when government planning fails, governments tend to make the call for some sort of dictator, economic dictator, he called it, but we call them czars in the U.S., you know, after the old Russian dictators. Okay. Another point that's worth commenting on here is when Hayek says, when it becomes dominated by a collectivist creed, democracy will eventually destroy itself. So he thinks that democracy is only possible with a liberal creed, a classical liberal creed. And this, I suspect, Hayek is thinking of James Madison in the Federalist Paper number 10. Because I know Hayek wrote about this in his other book, The Constitution of Liberty, which is another pretty famous book by Hayek that he wrote later after the Rhodes Serfdom. I think it was published in 1960. And in the Federalist Paper number 10, you know, the Federalist Papers were written by John Jay and Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, some of the American founding fathers. And they were making the case for the U.S. Constitution in the Federalist Papers. And the essays are all numbered. And essay number 10 was written by James Madison, where he made the case that he said that governments have everywhere been destroyed that did not control the violence of faction. He called it the violence of faction. Today we would call it interest group politics, and so, or unlimited government. You know, those democracies in history up to his time, you know, this is the 1780s, he's writing this, and the history of democracy was that if you allowed democracy to be unlimited, then inevitably what would happen is majorities would be controlled simply by the more powerful, and the legislation you would get would not necessarily be just and fair and good for the society, but just good for the powerful. And there would be a widespread feeling that the government was a cause of injustice, and that would destroy the system. And that, in a nutshell, that's the main argument of Federalist Paper number 10. And I think that is what Hayek is saying right here when he says, if it becomes dominated by a collectivist creed, democracy will inevitably destroy itself. And of course, the collectivist creed would be the government should do anything within its power in pursuit of the common good. And of course, if you allow who is to decide what the common good is? Well, the politicians themselves have always said that they would decide for us, the citizens, what the common good is. And if you give them that power, then they will assume unlimited power to do just about anything. And that's what Hayek is warning about. And that's pretty much where America is today, unfortunately. And this leads into a more general point. That democracy can be just as oppressive as a dictatorship if it is combined with a regime of widespread government planning as opposed to laissez-faire capitalism and very, very limited government. As I said in the last class, Hayek was no anarcho-capitalist. He was in favor of limited constitutional government, but he was not an anarcho-capitalist. And Friedrich Bastiat also made this same point in his famous little book, The Law, where you know, if democracy is used to impose one policy on the entire nation and use coercion, force, and threats to enforce that policy, which is what government is all about after all, you know, prison, police, armies, that's what government is, that's how it enforces its dictates, well then that's pretty much the same as dictatorship. You can call it democracy if you want, but it's pretty much the same thing. Bastiat made that point, and Hayek makes that point also in this fifth chapter. Okay, I'll answer questions later. I see some questions up there. On the rule of law, we mentioned this in the last class, amidst all the chaos of the audio problem. But the rule of law, you know, simply means that, in Hayek's sense, in the sense of classical liberalism, that the laws of a country ought to be clearly explained, easy to understand, and well known in advance to everyone, and they apply equally to everyone. Okay, there are no exceptions to the rule of law, and Hayek makes the case that government planning is inherently incompatible with the rule of law. Just as it is inherently incompatible with democracy, it is also inherently incompatible with the rule of law, because with planning, he uses an example. I think he mentions, once the government is deciding such things through planning of how many acres are to be farmed or how many pigs are to be raised, it is becoming arbitrary and is issuing rules, regulations, and dictates that will benefit some and harm others. They won't apply equally to everyone. They'll benefit some and harm others. And he was probably referring to the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, because the first several years of the so-called New Deal from 1933 to 1935 in the U.S., the government did, in the name of planning, it called it managed capitalism. They called it fascism in Europe, but it was called managed capitalism in the U.S. The government dictated to farmers how many acres they can plant. They forced them to slaughter livestock, because they thought if they increased the price of livestock, it would increase farmers' incomes, and that would help get rid of the Great Depression. It was a harebrained theory, but that was their theory, and that's what Hayek is alluding to here, I think. And so once you go down that road of planning, you've destroyed the whole idea of the rule of law, because plans, by their very definition, create arbitrary dictates that benefit some and harm others. These things, acreage allotments and paying farmers to not grow crops, well, that might benefit the farmers by pushing up the price of food, but it harms everybody else who has to pay the higher price of food. And so that's what he's talking about. And he makes the analogy in several places of when he talks about the rule of law, of the government. The government can establish the rules of the road, like we drive on the right-hand side, but that's sort of similar to the rule of law versus telling us where to go, telling us where to drive our car to, what city to drive to. That would be planning, versus the rule of law is just establishing the rules of the road, stop signs at intersections, you drive on the right-hand side, and so forth. That's the analogy he makes between planning and the rule of law. Totally different things altogether. There's another interesting quote on page 91 in my version of The Road to Serfdom. He says, by giving the government unlimited powers, the most arbitrary rule can be made legal. And in this way, a democracy may be set up as the most complete despotism imaginable. Well, that is certainly true. Adolf Hitler gained power under a democracy. There was the election, the Nazi Party did not get a majority in the 1932 election, but they got enough seats in the legislature that Hitler was able to get Hindenburg to appoint him as chancellor, and then he maneuvered himself into becoming dictator. And so democracy actually was the vehicle through which that Hitler used to establish his dictatorship. And, we can have dictatorial things that go on all the time. There's a book in Democracy. There's a book with the entertaining title called Constitutional Dictatorship by Clinton Rossiter, R-O-S-S-I-T-E-R. He was a professor, an Ivy League professor at for many years who taught history, Clinton Rossiter. And he has several chapters, a chapter on the Lincoln dictatorship, for example, and it's about constitutional dictatorships, about governments that have had constitutional democracies but have at times evolved into dictatorships. And you can see, I have the notes I wrote next to this in my notes here is, look at the U.S. today. We can go to war under false pretenses, weapons of mass destruction. And the whole world knows that was a lie behind why we got into the Iraq war. Now, even the American CIA has admitted that there never were any weapons of mass destruction and that they never had any evidence of that. But then once we went down that road, we have warrantless wiretaps and eavesdropping by the government on the Internet and on telephone conversations and all these attacks on civil liberties, they've all happened under democracy. And in fact, government tyrants often use the fact that democracy exists to justify their power. They'll say, "We've been elected. The people have spoken. So shut up. We're doing the people's will." And the people often acquiesce in this because they know they can have no effect on the system. My old friend Robert Higgs, who some of you know of, he wrote a famous book, Crisis and Leviathan, and many other things. He once said that the government allows us in America to have free speech because it knows it doesn't matter, that we don't have much influence on them with our free speech. And so that's the final point I wanted to mention with regard to that chapter by Hayek. And then I did put a chapter of it, and I put several chapters on the syllabus throughout of the book Omnipotent Government by von Mises, that I thought, these two books were published at about the same time. I think Omnipotent Government was published a year after The Road to Serfdom. And there's a lot of good material in there. And Mises has a definition of planning on page 250 of this book, which is online, of course. And I might as well read it because it's a little some similarities and some differences with Hayek. He said, "At any rate, planning always means planning by government authorities and execution of these plans by order of a government enforced by the police power. Planning is the antithesis of free enterprise and private ownership of the means of production. Planning and capitalism are utterly incompatible. Within a system of planning, production is conducted according to the government's orders, not according to the plans of the capitalist entrepreneurs eager to profit by the best serving the wants of consumers." And I think that's a really classic statement of what planning really is. And so to Mises, planning and government planning and capitalism cannot be reconciled. And he wrote another essay that's relevant here. It's called Middle of the Road Policy Leads to Socialism. And it's online at Mises.org. And the basic argument is that once you allow any kind of interventionism, price controls, for example, the price controls will inevitably cause shortages, as they always do, because when you drop the price below the free market price, you expand the amount demanded. People want more at the lower price, but it becomes less economical to supply the product, and so you have shortages. Shortages create a problem, so the government will adopt some sort of rationing scheme and giving itself even more power, and then that won't work. That'll cause even more problems, and so one intervention leads to another and another and another. And so in this essay, Mises explains why interventionism leads to more interventionism, ultimately to socialism. And it's similar to what he says here. He also says every socialist has his own brand of socialism, which is an interesting point that Hayek doesn't make anywhere. He also, in this chapter, he talks about world planning. I thought this is different than what Hayek was talking about. Hayek does talk about such things in his latter chapters at the very end of the book. But the point Mises makes is that in his day, people were talking about some sort of world government, the United Nations being the organization that would put an end to war. Well, that of course hasn't happened, has it? Look at the 20th century. But it's really democracy and capitalism, Mises says, are the surest routes to peace, not worldwide central planning. And he also says, in this book, written in 1944, that if we did have some sort of international planning organization, it would inevitably be captured or run by the wealthier countries who would use their power to benefit themselves at the expense of other countries. And, of course, that is what has happened. That's what happens whenever you have any governmental organization, whether it's domestic or international. There's going to be a power struggle where some will use the power of the government entity to benefit themselves at the expense of others. He also makes the point that in his day, he says that foreign trade agreements are likely to lead to what he calls hyper-protectionism. So he wasn't too keen on foreign trade agreements. And see, writing in the 1940s, what was happening was we had in the U.S. we had the Smoot-Hawley Tariff that Herbert Hoover signed in 1930, and it led to an international trade war They reduced the volume of world trade by two-thirds in 3 years. It was a calamity for the world, and it greatly contributed to the Great Depression around the world. It wasn't the main cause, but it certainly didn't help things much. It hurt a lot. And then after that, the trading countries of the world spent the next 70 years trying to undo the damage of that. Through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, it was called GATT. Some people used to say GATT stood for General Agreement to Talk and Talk. Every 8 years, these government officials would get together for months at a time and hold talks to supposedly reduce tariffs. And so that was just really getting started in when Mises was writing this book, and he was very pessimistic. He thought they would probably lead to more protectionism, because that's what was going on in his day. And so he wasn't very, he also has a great quote on the folly of monetary central planning, either domestically or internationally. It's on page 262 of his book, 263 rather. He discusses it on both of these pages, but here he's writing about the idea of governments trying to centrally plan the economy through monetary policy. Ben Bernanke's job. In other words, he says, it is a great comfort to every administration to be able to make its citizens happy by spending. For public opinion, he's being sarcastic here, by the way, for public opinion will then attribute the resulting boom to its current rulers. The inevitable slump will occur later and burden their successors. It is the typical policy of, then he has to use some French word, Lord Keynes, the champion of this policy, says, in the long run, we're all dead. But unfortunately, nearly all of us outlive the short run. We are destined to spend decades paying for the easy money orgy of a few years. Doesn't that sound like the United States today? We are destined to spend decades paying for the easy money orgy. Quantitative easing is what they call it today. Mises in 1944 called it the money orgy of a few years, and so I would recommend reading that chapter also. And I see it's 9:52, so I think that's what I had prepared for the lecture for tonight to discuss these chapters. And I do have a couple of questions here that I printed out right before the class. I'll address these, and then I'll look over the chat and see if we have some more questions in the chat. But the ones I printed out here an hour or two before the class, let's see. Okay, I think last week Benjamin wrote this up. There's a quote in Liberalism, page 51, where Mises says, it cannot be denied that fascism and similar movements were motivated by the best intentions, and that their intervention has for the moment saved European civilization. Well, keep in mind, Mises wrote this in 1927. Hitler didn't gain power until 1933, so he's not talking about the Hitler regime, to be sure. In the same part of Liberalism, he refers to communists as the archenemies of civilization. And in his day, the so-called fascist parties of Europe were the opponents, the main opponents of communism. They stopped communism. And so that's why he says, for the moment, they put a stop to the spread of communism in Europe. And he says, that's a good thing. And then later on in the same page, he goes to talk about how the condemns and criticizes the economic components of fascism, but I think he's actually praising some of the fascist politicians for at least temporarily stopping the spread of communism. And of course, it took Franklin Roosevelt to finally bring communism to much of Europe at the end of World War II, where he handed Eastern and Central Europe over to Joseph Stalin. So the fascists put a stop to the spread of communism, but it took FDR to restart it. And I think that's what he's talking about there. Let's see. Tom Armstrong wrote, Mises states that governments institute inflationary policies to stimulate exports. How does that work? Well, as a sort of a simple example, if you had two currencies, the U.S. dollar and the Chinese yuan, and let's say $100 equals 100 yuan parity, and then if we have price inflation in the U.S. that doubles the price level, the consumer price index, then you have $100 can only buy 50 yuan. And look at it backwards. Previously, if you wanted to buy a $100 product in America and you're in China, you would have to pay 100 yuan for a $100 product. But now because of American inflation, the ratio is 100 to 50. So you only need 50 yuan to buy that $100 product. If you want to talk bigger money, if you had a $10,000 American car, now you only need, and you needed 10,000 yuan to get $10,000 so you could buy the car, the American car. Now you only need 5,000 yuan to be able to buy that $10,000 American car. And so that's why exports, the theory goes, will increase as far as that goes. Let's see, another question. If the U.S. ended further credit expansion and inflation, this is Tom Armstrong again, and returned to a gold standard, would it necessarily be deflationary? Well, even if it was deflationary, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We had price deflation in the United States from the end of the Civil War, which was 1865, until almost the end of the century, until 35 years. And the main reason was the Industrial Revolution. There was a great deal of production, supply. And so the growth of supply in the economy outstripped the growth of consumer demand for several decades. And as a result, there was price deflation. And so that was good price deflation. And so that was not a bad thing at all. If the deflation is caused by increased work, savings, investment, and production, that's good. There's nothing wrong with that because there was increased employment, more products, better products, cheaper products. It was all good. And so deflation is not necessarily a bad thing. And of course, the whole history for several thousands of years of why people chose gold as a money is that it did place a check on the inflationary proclivities of governments. So yes, we would have less inflation, and if it was deflationary, it's not necessarily a bad thing by any means. I would love to pay 50% less for the next new car I buy. Let me see. I'll look for some of the chat group here. See if I can find some questions. A lot of discussion. Let's see, Tom Armstrong again. Weren't the Federalist Papers propaganda of the central planners of the day? Well, you should read my book, Hamilton's Curse, for the full answer to that question. But the Federalist Papers were the case for the U.S. Constitution. I don't think Madison was on the same wavelength as John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was very Machiavellian. He wanted the Constitutional Convention more than anyone. He lobbied for it for 7 years. And the original American Constitution was called the Articles of Confederation. And they did not give the federal government taxing power. Any taxes were raised by the states. And, of course, the federal government was not given income taxing power until 1913, so they never did give the government in the original Constitution taxing power. But Hamilton, especially, and his party, the Federalists, they wanted the government to be much more centralized. Hamilton wanted a central bank modeled after the Bank of England that would provide subsidies to favored corporations. He wanted corporate welfare. He was a protectionist, and he was just a big government central planner. He was, and so yes, Hamilton in his essays, he had an agenda, but he did not expose that agenda in his essays in the Federalist Papers. He sounds like a states' rights Jeffersonian conservative in a lot of the essays there, and then after the after the U.S. Constitution was adopted, Alexander Hamilton spent the rest of his life trying to explode government far beyond what the Constitution allowed it to be. For example, it was Alexander Hamilton who invented the notion of implied powers of the Constitution. And if you go down that road and you say that there are not just powers granted explicitly by this document, but if you read between the lines, there are implied powers. Well, politicians will imply unlimited power if you let them do that. And it was Hamilton who first made that argument. And I go through this in chapter and verse in my book, Hamilton's Curse. And so the answer to the question is, no, the Federalist Papers themselves, what they say is not as offensive as what Hamilton really had in mind and wanting to do once he got this Constitution. And by the way, once the Constitution was ratified, Hamilton himself condemned it as, in his words, a frail and worthless fabric because it did not centralize governmental power in the way that he wanted. For example, at the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton proposed a permanent president who would appoint all the governors of the states who would have power to veto all state legislation. So he would have had a king, and the governors would have been the king's puppets. That was exactly the British system, exactly. And the British system of government would have adopted British mercantilism as its economic policy, corporate welfare, central banking, high tariffs, protectionism. That was British mercantilism. And so it's sort of a little more complicated than saying the Federalist Papers were central planning propaganda. Let's see. Let's see. Well, there's a statement by Hayek, or by the Mises Institute. Let's see, Paola Romero. In what sense can we talk about Lincoln as a dictator? You can read it, a lot of my writings, but Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. He imprisoned tens of thousands of political dissenters in the northern states. He shut down over 300 newspapers, opposition newspapers. He confiscated firearms in the border states, censored all of communication. He adopted military conscription. And the American historians for decades have called Lincoln a dictator, but a good dictator. And so... You can take that in whatever way you want to take that, but my book, The Real Lincoln, explains it all in chapter and verse. But that's a pretty good start, I think, in looking at dictatorial behavior. Let's see, had von Mises a more favorable opinion of the democracy? Well, they both warned about democracy. Mises, you could probably make an argument that von Mises wasn't quite as critical. I'm thinking that Hayek wrote another three-volume set of books called Law, Legislation, and Liberty in the mid-1970s. And by then, he had incorporated a lot of the literature in the field of public choice from economics, which was the economic analysis of political decision-making, studying the incentives, basically, that exist in politics. And it came up with a whole body of literature on what's called government failure, the theory of government failure. And Hayek incorporated a lot of that into Law, Legislation, and Liberty, especially Volume 3 of Law, Legislation, and Liberty. And so his writings were much more extensive on the failures of democracy than were Mises, although Mises was certainly not naive about it, but Hayek just wrote more about it, I think. Let's see. We have Brian Leach's first cousin six times removed from Abe Lincoln. How about that? So on the topic of buying votes to make government look good here, the economy look good, there's also a literature in economics on something called the political business cycle that you can look up. And it's been around for several decades. And the idea is that politicians of all parties understand that voters have a fairly short-term time horizon. They might not remember at all what you did as a member of Congress a year ago, but they will remember probably what you did 3 months ago. And so if 3 to 6 months before every election, politicians will vote for an explosion of spending, regardless of whether or not economic theory that is in the macroeconomics textbooks recommends that or not, there's going to be a big bump up in spending and money printing before the election to try to stimulate the economy, as they say. Whether it works or not is another question. But what it does do, it does work in that if the money is used to target specific constituencies, for example, the Democrats always want to spend on infrastructure to subsidize the unionized construction companies, and then the unionized construction companies kick back a lot of that money in the form of campaign contributions. Now, the so-called kickbacks are illegal, but not if you're a politician. So that's essentially a kickback using taxpayers' money. And so this whole literature on political business cycles is on how this phenomenon creates additional instability in the economy as a whole because of this type of behavior. And you can look it up. It's a huge literature. If you just Google it, you'll find lots of articles. Let's see, how can we explain that the world today tends to the left, to planning, government intervention? Well, one explanation that's been given by a lot of people is that governments always control the educational system of a country and influence very heavily the media of a country. And so if you start brainwashing children at an early age in statism and interventionism, which certainly the public schools do, that's a tool of control. And the media, I think there's a dynamic with the media in that if you're a journalist and you are critical of politicians, they will cut you off from your information sources. If you're a journalist, you rely on news, and news has to be new. If you can't get new news, you're not going to have much of a successful career as a journalist. And so if you're too critical of politicians, they will cut you off and they won't give you the latest development coming out of Washington, D.C., for example. And so as a result, even if you're not an ideological leftist, you have to play the game and not be too critical of government if you want a career in journalism. And I think that's just how the system works. But then, of course, it's also true that I know I'm speaking only for American schools of journalism. They are very heavily ideological in brainwashing academies on the left. And so the left and government funding of education has a lot to do with that also. And so I think that is always a priority of government, and I think that explains a lot of what's going on. In Mises' famous book, Human Action, in some of the latter chapters, he makes the case for economic education. People who are educated in economics are always the enemies of the state because they can see through the false promises and the phony programs that the state promises, all the money for nothing schemes, like the minimum wage law, for example, that the state promises. And so people who understand basic economics are not liable to go along with all of these schemes. And that's why most Americans, what the little they know about economics is taught to them by professional non-economists at the universities. The historians, the philosophers, the sociologists, they all spout off on economics, even though they don't know anything about it and they never studied it. And so even if you do take one or two courses, a lot of that is diluted by all of the economic nonsense you get elsewhere in higher education in America. Let's see if I can get some more questions here. See, Alexander Keating, isn't deflation bad? Well, deflation bad is deflation can be bad if the cause is a depression, in which wrecks demand. People don't have money and can't purchase things. Now that's sort of bad deflation. But good deflation is caused by increased production. Well, that's true. It means that if wages are inflexible downward, they're not that way in a free market. They're that way because of laws that favor unions or minimum wage laws and so forth. But in a free market, wages are flexible downward. And so in a deflationary period, like in the Depression, if there's a reduction in the demand for labor by employers, that means you can save your job if you can take a pay cut. But if the government props up the wage, you're not allowed that choice. The government will tell the employer, no, you can't negotiate a temporary pay cut and keep this person on the job. And so therefore, that person will lose their job. Let's see, here's from Nikki. Hornberger expresses in his article that in America we have a redistribution of wealth, but have yet to lose the terrifying and paralyzing fear of politicians and bureaucrats. I find it often to be the case that many people tend to think government must know best. How do we overcome this mentality? He also notes, to alter or abolish government is a must for freedom. But this is terrifying to Americans themselves. Yes, freedom. Well, Ron Paul was interviewed by Matt Lauer about a week or 10 days ago. And the first thing Matt Lauer, who was a talking head on one of the morning American news shows, said was to call him a radical, you know, these radical ideas. And Ron Paul said, well, wait a minute, freedom is radical? Why is that radical? And when I heard of this, I saw it on YouTube. I'm thinking, here's Matt Lauer, who voted for the man, Obama, who wants to impose Soviet-style medical care on America. That's not radical. Freedom is radical. It starts with the education system. As I alluded to earlier, I think from grade school on, the government schools, there are exceptions, but they teach government propaganda for the most part, the government's interpretation of history and so forth. That's why whenever I talk to parents, I tell them every parent must be a homeschool parent to some degree. Even if you send your children to a school, if you want to do anything about this, you have to also keep tabs on what they're learning and supplement their education. If not, they'll just become sheep like the rest of the people whose parents don't do anything, never intervene, and give all the educational responsibilities to the state. That's what you do when you send your kids to public school. You're handing over your child's mind to the state. That's why people do think government must know best. They've been taught that their whole lives, and it's in the popular culture, too. It's in the movies and so forth. Let's see, if the U.S. imposes inflation, wouldn't that be good because we have a trade surplus? Well, a trade surplus is not necessarily what does that mean, a trade surplus? We want more trade is what we want. If when we buy more from other countries than they buy from us, there are a lot of reasons for that. It's not just inflation, and so the trade surplus is just really just a statistical artifact. What we want is prosperity, and to be able to consume more goods and have a better life. But trade deficits and surpluses are just really statistical artifacts that are used primarily by special interests, protectionists for the most part, to argue for policies that restrict trade. What we want is more trade in general. No audio. Everybody else seems to have audio. Let's see, Paul is saying, Nikki, it's hard to change people's minds. Well, that's why the left has always tried to monopolize education of the young. They don't try to change the mind of a 50-year-old man. They try to educate the children on these things. That's always been their strategy, and it has to be the strategy of people who advocate freedom over tyranny as well. Something about insanity here. Here's a question. In chapter 4, the conception of complete ethical code. What is this ethical code? I think one type of ethical code that Hayek is talking about would be, for example, respect for private property. If we had an ethical code that's conducive to liberalism and freedom, respect for private property, he's saying that it's not just laws that enforce private property, but you have to have an understanding on the part of the public that private property is a desirable thing, and that you should not interfere with other people's property if it is legally and peacefully acquired property. I think that's an example of what he's talking about. Let's see, Mises does talk about immigration. I think at one point he talks about, he's alluding to what economists call the theory of one price. If wages are higher in one country than another country, then if there were free immigration, what would happen is some people from the lower wage country would migrate to the higher wage country, and that would drop wages somewhat there in the higher wage country. And at the same time, the reduction in supply of labor in the low-wage country would increase wages there so that they would tend toward equalization. Then he makes the point that there are a lot of government barriers to immigration, and so that tendency toward equalization of wages doesn't occur in the real world. It's just a theory. But that's what he's referring to in that particular passage. And as far as employment, well, you don't have unemployment if wages go down, if wages are flexible. If more immigrants come in and the wages go down, you might have lower wages, but not necessarily unemployment, as long as wages are flexible. Let's see, from Graham. The use of child labor. Child labor is sometimes used as a gimmick by labor unions, whose real desire is to throw young people who work in third world countries out of work altogether. Because in some countries, and this was true in the United States at one period, people who send children, maybe 12-year-old children, into a factory, don't do it because they love the idea of sending their children into a factory, but the alternative for those children might be prostitution, begging, stealing, starvation. And so compared to that, working in a factory, as bad as it is not a good thing. A lot of the so-called critics of child labor act as though the realistic alternative to children like this is to enter a $20,000 a year private school in Washington, D.C. That's not the alternative. The alternative is often child prostitution, begging, stealing, starvation, not having enough money to feed the new baby who will likely die in the family, and so forth. And so labor unions often protest corporations who employ teenage labor in Singapore or someplace like that. They're not doing it because they're concerned about the well-being of the children in these countries. Quite the opposite. They want the well-being of these children to diminish. They want these factories to close down, and so the end result would be the children, some of them, would resort to prostitution or stealing or things like that, because they don't want competition from low-wage countries competing with high-wage union labor. And historically, it's capitalism that ended child labor. Because what did capitalism do? Capital investment by the capitalists increased the productivity of labor. When capitalists started investing in better technology, better machinery, it made labor more productive. A farm worker who could ride on a tractor was much more productive than the same person who walked behind a horse and a plow all day long. And so the worker did not improve his ability or his strength or his hours worked or anything else. It was the capital investment that made him more productive and thereby more valuable to the employer. And so employers had to compete for workers in the competitive labor market. So as productivity went up, the employers had to compete for the workers by offering them higher wages, or else they would lose all of the increased productivity that their investment had made possible. And so the main reason for the increased wages over time during the American Industrial Revolution and the European Industrial Revolution was capital investment by entrepreneurs. The workers were essentially free riders or freeloaders on the risk-taking and investment in monetary sacrifice of the capitalists in that regard, and they increased their wages. That's the only way you could have had fewer working hours and higher pay, which we did have. It's the only way you could have the situation of where the families no longer had to send the 10-year-old or the 12-year-old to the factory with the father. Because now, since they had higher wages, they could afford to feed and clothe and shelter everyone without sending the kids to the factory. And so child labor was eliminated by capitalism long before labor unions did anything about it and long before the government passed any laws about child labor. And in most instances, when the government did pass laws about child labor, they were just pandering to labor unions who did not want competition. They weren't doing it for the benefit of the young workers. They were doing it to the detriment of the young workers and the benefit of the labor unions, who, after all, were the ones who were making campaign contributions to their careers, not the 10 and 12-year-old factory workers. Let's see. Even the Pledge of Allegiance was written in Indoctrinate to Kids. I've written about this in my book, Lincoln Unmasked. The Pledge of Allegiance in America was in the late 1880s. It was not a part of the Founding Father generation. It was authored by a man named Francis Bellamy, who was a defrocked Baptist minister from New England, who was kicked out of the pulpit of his church for preaching that Jesus Christ was a socialist. And he was the cousin of Edward Bellamy, who wrote a book called Looking Backward. It was a novel about a man who fell asleep in the 1880s and woke up in the year 2000, and America had been turned into a socialist paradise. And Francis Bellamy said, in his own words, that the main purpose of the Pledge of Allegiance is to inculcate in the minds of children obedience to the centralized state that was created by Abraham Lincoln especially. He mentioned Lincoln especially, because he really was the creator of the highly centralized bureaucratic state that America is today. It was highly decentralized. Such things as states' rights, nullification, and secession existed in America as rights, as fundamental political rights, prior to the American Civil War of the 1860s. And so, and I quote that, there's a man, if you do a web search, there's a man, I can't remember his last name, Rex something, has articles on the origins of the Pledge of Allegiance, and he has pictures of American school children until the 1930s, I believe, were taught to hold their hands out like this, while they said the pledge. And it looked too much like this, eventually. It looked too much like a Nazi salute, and so they discontinued that. But you can see pictures of this, very creepy pictures of this on the web, of if you just type in pictures of children saying the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1930s, you'd probably find some articles. Well, I don't have solutions to how we can gradually reform education. Homeschooling is a great thing. Don't send your kids to government schools. But they're very powerful. Yeah, Rex Curry, Chris Branco. Yeah, if you Google Rex Curry and Pledge of Allegiance, you'll find all his articles and pictures. Curry. Yeah. Everyone wants to know the magic bullet about the federal courts. Well, you know, most people in America think horizontally about politics. They think of Democrats and Republicans, you know, how can we get our guy in on the Supreme Court or the presidency? But you can also think vertically in terms of devolving power, you know, the devolution of power away from Washington, D.C. And that involves nullification of federal laws that are unconstitutional by the states. That's possible. My old friend Tom Woods wrote a popular book about that recently. It's called Nullification. Secession is also the other alternative. There are a lot of people who are really serious. Look up something called Second Vermont Republic if you want to see some people who are very serious about the state of Vermont seceding from the United States and creating its own little country. And that's a way of thinking vertically, if you will, in terms of the devolution of government power away from the center as opposed to the constant left and right, which I think is futile because there's not a dime's worth of difference between them, as the old saying goes. The Bob Murphy fan here, Nathaniel. Well, if there are no more questions, I have almost 10:30. Feel free to email me personally if you have some burning issue or anything else. It's I put it on the chat. It's tdilo@aol.com, tdilo@aol.com. I'd be glad to answer questions if I can on anything. And thanks again for showing up. I hope the audio was great tonight. No complaints that I see. And we'll do it again next week. And I hope you're enjoying The Road to Serfdom. It really is a great book by Hayek. Very interesting, thought-provoking, and just chock full of all kinds of ideas, even though I don't agree with all of them, even me. And have a good night. Take care.